This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Also sponsored by Windstar Farm. Now here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, the Pontiff of the Pick Four, Pope Jude Feld, sitting in with me here on the on this Trainer Talk program here tonight. We are in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and welcome everybody joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220, XM 206, and those of you tuning in worldwide on our website at horseracingradio.net. And don't forget, you can access the live streaming on your computer, your smartphone, or your tablet every time we're on the air, and all those podcasts of each and every program available for you on our website as well. It's all there for you, horseracingradio.net. Jude, we embark upon 2016, and when we look back on 2015, and you look at the number of people and the different countries that were represented in coming to the Horse Racing Radio Network website to listen, that does not include the people tuning in around the country on Sirius XM and on our terrestrial affiliates, listeners in more than 160 countries making us their home for racing in 2015, and we can't thank everybody enough.
Yeah, my goal is to get the other 30 countries on board now. Somebody told me there was 190. I didn't even know there was 160. So,
well, I think maybe tonight's guest, you think he's a household name in many of those, or at least in most of the states?
I don't know. Do they know him in Myanmar? They probably do.
Well, we're going to find out. Tonight, we're going to be joined by a very special guest, and this is somebody who I have wanted to have on the program for a very long time, and we make it happen for you here today. He joins us just 9 days shy of his 76th birthday, and the native of New Orleans, Louisiana, has trained, how about this, 3,358 career winners. His runners have earned more than $57 million in purses, and he has saddled a plethora of graded stakes winners, with his first coming in 1988 and his most recent 2014. Yeah, he's been doing this and succeeding at a very high level for a very long time. He is trainer Bernie Flint, and he joins us now on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Bernie, welcome to the program, my friend.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, happy to have you on board, and really looking forward to hearing your story and looking back on your storied career. I mentioned those numbers, more than 3,300 career winners, $57 million in purses. What's the first thing that pops into your mind when you hear those numbers?
Wow. I can't believe it's been that long. You know, it all seems like a flash, you know?
Yeah, and you know, you didn't come to training horses in the conventional manner, so to speak. Like a lot of the trainers that come on this program will say, hey, I was born into it. I worked on the farm. I went and started working on the racetrack at a very young age. For you, it was a little bit of a different story. Take us back to the beginning and tell us how Bernie Flint got started.
Well, actually, when I was young, we were riding quarter horses in South Louisiana, more in the show ring than any place else. And I found that it was very expensive, you know, even in those days, to take care of a horse. So I'd ride for other people. And eventually, we went to the quarter horse sales around the country with these traders, and I rode horses for them and showed them. And eventually, I got into the show end and training show horses, Western horses. And they had two divisions. They had the American Quarter Horse Association and the National Quarter Horse Association, I believe. And most horses weren't even really registered. So what happened was when I started riding the quarter horses, I couldn't make any money. So, you know, you got $50 to break a horse, and most of the time you got busted up pretty good breaking one. But again, those days, slipped on by, and I got into, I needed a job. I went to college for 1 year, and I couldn't, you know, I just couldn't make it. So I decided I'd go sign up for the police department. Well, I really didn't decide to go to the police. I wanted to be a fireman. And they had a line. I had 1 year of college. They had a line for firemen, and they had a line for policemen. So I got in the fireman line, and when I got up to the front, they said, well, we're not hiring anybody any longer, so you'd have to go somewhere else to be a fireman. Well, one of my buddies were in the police, was in the police line, and he said, hey, come on over here, Bernie. All your friends that went to school with you, a lot of them were on the police, and you'd probably like it. So I didn't like it because the pay was like $285 a month with $2 an hour overtime and shift work, very rough shift work in those days. He worked from 7 to 3, 3 to 11, and 11 to 7. And you changed every month. So somehow or another, I signed up and went to the police academy. And being quite tall, 6 foot 4, 220 pounds, 210 pounds, you know, they were hiring police in those days. If you were over 5 foot 8 and you had a high school education, and a clean record, they'd hire you on the police department if you passed certain physical tests. So when I went on through the academy with no problem whatsoever and became a policeman. And from then on, it was robbery, burglary, homicide, narcotics. And after 16 years, no age limit, I could get 40% of my pay. And if I stood on for 20 years, no age limit, I could have got 50% of my pay. Well, about toward the end of my police career, you know, I was 36 years old, and I had, at the time, a couple of kids and a wife, and I wasn't making it with the police because there just wasn't enough money in those days. They didn't pay a policeman very much. So what happened was I knew about horses quite a bit, more than the average guy because I've ridden them and trained them, and a friend of mine told me, why don't you just try to be a thoroughbred trainer. I said, my God, I said, I don't know anything about thoroughbred. He says, you know more about horses than most of the thoroughbred trainers know because you've been riding them and you've been showing them, and I know you. And he was a sea captain that worked in the racing office in Louisiana. God knows I can't remember his name right now, but I said, okay, well, let me look into that. So I bought a horse by the name of House Seats from J.R. Smith. And for $1,500, and I didn't have enough money to pay for him. So what I did was I sold half for $750, and I put up to $750, and that was the start of the whole business.
Wow. Well, $750 is how it all got started for Bernie Flint.
Yeah, and that's the amazing thing when you hear the stats, because a lot of the places you raced, Bernie, didn't have the purses that we're used to today, yet you were able to bank $57 million in purses over your career so far. Yeah, hard way to make a living.
Yes, it was. It was pretty tough, but I enjoyed it. I loved every minute of it. And in those days, you know, you had a lot of people, and most of them were locals, that were on the racetrack, you know, and you could get a lot of help, local help that needed jobs, and it was easy to get employees, and the whole business was quite different in those days, you know. So, you know, horses were my life, you know, up till that point.
Bernie, you mentioned not necessarily wanting to be a police officer, wanting to be a fireman, but you did stay on the police force for 16 years. When you were on the force, did you keep in touch with horse racing? Were you still kind of following it, or did you distance yourself from the sport completely?
Well, later on, out of my police term, I decided I was going to train some horses, and you know, like I tell you a little story about the sea captain talked me into it, and I got into it part-time. In other words, I'd work 8 hours as a policeman. Many times, you know, I went to school at night. I went to Loyola University and graduated from Loyola with a police scholarship when I was a policeman. But I had to put in my 8 hours a day, too. So not only was I working the 8 hours a day, I was going to college at night and training horses. So I had a pretty full schedule, and I kept to it. I found later on that I was making more money training horses than I was as a policeman. So with no age limit and 36 years of age, I turned in my papers.
A little bit safer being a horse trainer, too, than a police officer in New Orleans, I would imagine.
Well, you know, I thought I was bulletproof. And after losing a couple of partners and Howard Johnson's incident, where the Black Panther took over the Howard Johnson's with a sniper rifle, and we lost Superintendent Sergo, who was standing right next to me when he got shot. You know, I had a little bit different outlook on, you know, the police department. And things were changing. It was not the time to be a police officer. And I think that was 72 or 4, something like, maybe 74.
I can imagine, Bernie. By the way, Bernie Flint joining us on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. Bernie, when you have an occurrence like that in your life and you lose somebody and you're right there with them, that kind of changes your whole perspective and your outlook on life too, doesn't it?
It really does. People seem to think that it doesn't, but it really does. When you see a fellow officer get killed right next to you, it changes your outlook on, you know, what you want to do and how far you want to go with the job. And personally, it affects you mentally. I don't care what anybody says. Some people, you know, can adhere to it, and some people can. And I just couldn't take the drag of that along with me being a policeman. I had enough of it. I saw this years and years and years ago. Things were changing. You know, in the old days, when you were a policeman, you didn't shoot people. You didn't have to. You know, you pick them up, put them in the car, bring them to jail, and usually if they did something wrong, they'd be convicted, and if they didn't do anything wrong, they'd be turned loose. But a police officer had a lot of respect, which means a lot. Without having any respect, you know, it's very hard to be a policeman, almost impossible. And as the times were changing and everything was changing with the police department, they're hiring women 5'1", 5'2". They're hiring guys that, you know, are overweight, too short, not big enough. It's almost impossible, you know, to handle suspects when, say, you're 5'2", or you're a man that's 5'3", and you're going to pick up a guy that's 6'6", that was a football player and was a bully all his life. You know you're going to have to go to other extremes to arrest him. So all this was part of it. And times were changing, you know, and it's just a different world out there than when I was on the police. I mean, it's just a different world. We'd have detectives that people would call up, you know, and I was a detective, and they'd call up and turn people in. I mean, they didn't want them in their neighborhood. They lost all the neighborhood values. In other words, you did something wrong in somebody's neighborhood. I mean, they didn't want that to go on. And that's what was very important and helped us out a lot. So all that started changing, and you know what happened from there on.
Did the adversity that you faced being a police officer, did it help you kind of keep an even keel when you started training horses?
Well, to be honest with you, I like horses better than people. I hate to say it, but I still ride every day. I've got a pony. He was a rescue horse. I paid $1,000 for him, and I ride him every day. I had this one for over a year, and he's a really, really good horse. And I like being on him, and I can watch business a lot better on horseback. What's amazing to me is not many trainers today can even ride. It's unbelievable. that they can't handle the horse. And in the old days, if you didn't ride, I don't think you could train a horse, you know. But apparently it's all gone to notebooks, suitcases, and computers. And horse sense is something of the past.
Well, it's interesting.
And I might like to get into that with you sometime along this conversation if we have enough time.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, Bernie, because oftentimes for those of us who are hanging out at the racetrack, working around the racetrack, as Jude and I have done for many years, you'll hear people say there are horsemen and there are trainers, and there's a distinct difference between those two categories, and it sounds like that's exactly what you're talking about.
Basically, yes. Yes.
All right, so if you're going to categorize a horseman and a trainer.
People don't realize that a true horseman can pick up a horse that was pretty much scrapped, put him back together, get him back to the races, and win with him. A true horseman. But you have to be able to know what you're dealing with from all kinds of angles. In the old days, it seems to me like there was more horsemen around than they had, you know, I call them briefcase trainers. But today you see a trainer with a briefcase flying from one racetrack to the other. And how in the world can he know what his horses are doing when he's 1,000 miles away from them training some more horses somewhere else? I never could understand that. And they did pass a rule one time that if you have horses at two different racetracks, you had to be at that racetrack where your horses were at least 1 in 7 days. And Jack Vanberg would be on an airplane 7 days a week because he had that many horses he was training, flying around. And that was the law. If you weren't at the racetrack at least 1 out of 7 days, then you had to put your horses in somebody else's name. And that happened to me a lot because I had two strings of cheap horses, and I had to run some in my assistant trainer's name and some in my wife's name, and to go on and on and on to be able to apply the rules because we weren't making enough money to be flying around like some of the other trainers were doing. And when you do that, when you do such a thing, it affects your record. So when you said I had 3,300 and some odd wins, it might very well be 3,500 wins, or maybe 3,700 wins, which makes no difference. It's just numbers, as far as I'm concerned, with the wins. The wins are nice to have in your column, but how did you earn them? Did you have 200 horses in training or 300 horses in training? But when you have a trainer that doesn't have that, it has maybe 50 in training, 25 at one track and 25 at another track, it's pretty hard to do.
Yeah, how many horses do you think really is the right number for one guy to train at a time?
I'm going to be honest with you. With the rules they have with the racehorse industry now, pretty much if you have 25 horses, so to say, with the drug rules they have going on now, which is absolutely stupid. When I'll get into that. But when you have, it's hard to watch more than 25 horses, much less 12 people that take care of the 25 horses. And that's what the problem lies in now in this business, because they have machines that pick up picograms, which is a trillionth of a gram, and nanograms, which is a billionth of a gram of substance that, you know, my God, you might stick your hand in your pocket and have a bill that was tainted with cocaine by somebody snorting with it, and you touch your horse's tongue, your horse is going to be positive for possession of having a drug, illegal drug, which they have zero backup on that. I mean, they say they can't stand even one picogram of that in the horse's system. But you got to watch the 12 people that are taking care of the horses, plus your horses, plus whatever they might have in their pockets. And they got to straighten that out, because it's getting to the point now where it's just absolutely overboard the other way. I believe that a horse can be affected by drugs. There ought to be a threshold. a threshold, so to say, that would affect a horse and would it not affect a horse. In the old days, nobody cared. They really never, nobody even really worried about drugs because we had a lot stronger horses than we have today. These horses today, I'm shocked when I look up their race record. They last 10 starts, 8 starts, maybe 12 starts, and they're gone. You know, and what happened to the good horses in the old days when they used to last and run like, let's say Seabiscuit ran 10 times or 12 times as a 2-year-old. Whatever happened to these horses? They just don't breed them anymore. You getting the gist of what I'm saying? I mean, the horses, they breed horses when they're bleeders or when they're broke down and everything else, and they diluted the breed so much that they're so fragile today that, my God almighty, Mitch Kenny used to ride swaps at the fairgrounds racetrack as a pony, use him as a pony and then run him in the evening in the races. Today, they'd have a heart attack if they saw something like that.
And there's no question about that.
So, Bernie, do you have to...
Oh, my God, he used to haul him in an open 18-wheeler with no top from one part of the country to the other and have a ramp and unload him from the ramp. I've seen them do it. Man. I mean, it was a different. Those horses, my God almighty, they ran with, like, Swaps ran many of his races with a quarter track. And they had no epoxy glue to glue the horse's foot back together and such as that. You know, they had to just be a horseman and deal with it. And a horse had to deal with the quarter track. You know, how they did it was put them in ice twice a day and work on them. And kept him running. You know what he went on to do, Swaps.
Yeah, he was an amazing horse. We had David Hoffman's on the show a while back, and he used to train for Ben Ritter. And we were kind of laughing about Mr. Ritter used to have two fields, one with the Colts and one with the Phillies. And whoever was alive when it came time to break, they'd bring him in and break him. And those horses were tough, horses like Flying Paster and Cascapedia. And, you know, that was later on after the Ellsworth era. But those were the best horses in California. And they were raised like old plow horses, you know, out in a big old field. And they were very, very tough.
When I was in Lexington, I had the pleasure to go to Preston Madden's farm. And he said, come on, Bernie, take a ride with me. I said, where are we going? We're going out in this field over here. We're going to see which one of these colts can run. I said, well, how are you going to do that, Preston? He said, get in the car. He got in his Cadillac, had a guy open the gate. He drove out in the field. He chased the colts through the field, which was probably 500 acres, with his Cadillac blowing the horn. And he said, this is how I check out which ones can run and which ones can't. And I was thoroughly amazed at that.
Bernie Flint here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. So, Bernie, with all that being said, have you had to adjust your approach to training horses as you've moved throughout your career over the past, four decades or so?
The biggest adjustment that we had to make, you know, with these animals is to keep them moving and keep them going forward with the dilution of the soundness in the breed. It's a shame to say it, but they have diluted the breed so much with problems that when you go to sales, I mean, it is almost impossible to sell a horse without a veterinarian report, without a scope report, without a heart test, and all kinds of procedures they put them through. Before you spend the money to buy horses. And that's what has, you know, really changed the business a lot. You know, they in Europe, I'm not so sure how they breed over there. I've not been to Europe at all. But I believe, you know, as far as racing goes, I've been there to Europe, but never racing. I believe they don't breed bleeders, per se. If a horse is a bleeder, they don't breed them. If a horse is broken down, 9 times out of 10, they better have a good reason, or they won't stand them at stud. And this is what's happened, you know, to the breed. I mean, they're not the same horses they used to be. Remember you telling me about looked like a bunch of plow horses running around in the field. Well, that's about what they were, okay? You couldn't hurt them. I mean, they were almost impossible to hurt these old horses because their bones, it was so strong, and they were so strong. You know, it's a hell of a note when you have to train an animal that can't take it. I mean, that's like a football player that can't take a hit. You know, and you watch Saturday night football and Sunday football and Monday night football, rather, and you see these football players being hauled off after every play. I mean, even the people aren't as strong as what they used to be. And today, I mean, everything has, the country's so big and the population's so big and the horse population's so big, I have people call me up every day wanting me to take a horse that they have a problem with and that they can't handle and things such as that, and beg me to run it for them or help them out, where I told them, I said, you know, all it's going to do is cost you money and me money unless you have the right kind of horse. And I try to discourage people from, you know, buying those kind of horses, you know, that's weak and that don't have a good production record and don't have a good race record and their family hasn't been raced very well. It's very important when you claim a horse or when you look at horses to see what their mother does and what their fathers do, the dams and the sires. Dams 80%. The sire's 20%. In most cases, you get the exceptional sire, such as Tappet or Giant's Causeway or that type. You have a better sire that strengthens the mare, more to say, 60% sire and 40% mare. And that's why they demand the stud fees they do, because it can only cover so many mares.
He's trainer Bernie Flint here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Really fun first half of the program. We're going to continue this discussion in the second half of the show. So, Bernie, stay with us. We'll encourage all of our listeners across HRN Nation to stay with us as well. We're back with the second half of the program. The second half hour of this hour-long Trainer Talk. It comes up next. Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
For your best chance at success, shop Fasig Tipton Selected Sales. Annually ranked at the top of all major North American sales by percentage of Grade 1 winners and graded stakes winners produced, that trend continued at the 2015 Breeders' Cup World Championships. Fasig Tipton Selected Sales grads won 6 Breeders' Cup races at Keeneland, with victories by such stars as American Pharaoh, Stop Charging Maria, Songbird, Nyquist, Teppan, and Waybell Avenue. Fasig Tipton Selected Sales. Where will you be? For more information, please visit FasigTipton.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Russell Maya, what a finish in the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm, dedicated to the dream.
And they're off to New York, the premier state-bred program in the United States. When you own a New York bred, your horse can run for more than $44 million in purses restricted to registered New York breds. And the New York program pays awards to breeders, owners, and stallion owners when their New York breds finish first, second, or third at New York tracks. We have the quality.
Day at the spa, all the way.
You have the opportunity. New York breds, get with the program. The best program.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network. But the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Sense of style has yet to find running room. Here's in the gold, Dance Away Capone and Sharp Lisa to tackle mismatched. Sense of style is still buried in heavy traffic inside the eighth pole. In the Darley Alcibiades, Sharp Lisa dives to the inside. In the gold, a short lead. A late run from far, far back as they come to the line. Far outside, charging up is Runway Model. It's a photo finish in the Darley Alcibiades, Runway Model or Sharp Lisa. And then in the gold, and 1:44 and 1.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Jude Feld, continuing our visit with trainer Bernie Flint in our Lexington studios. Of course, Bernie down at the fairgrounds, so he joins us from there on the program this evening. And you heard that clip right there coming out of the commercial break. Runway Model taking the Darley Alcibiades at Keeneland back in 2004. She is one of several stakes winners trained by Bernie Flint. And we told you his numbers at the top of the show. More than 3,300 career winners. And boy, that's one that's going to stand out to him, JT.
Yeah, that was a great day. I was there that day. I think I actually interviewed Bernie after the race. He was pretty happy.
Yeah, I can imagine. Our good friend Kurt Becker had the call of the race. And Bernie, when you think back on that day and so many of those stakes races, but that day in particular had to be very special for you.
Oh, yes. I bought that filly for $50,000, and she went on to make right under $800,000. And when we sold her at the sales, she brought $2.5 million.
Wow. That's what this game's all about, right?
That's what it's all about. But again, you know, like I said, it's just a business where you got to love it if you're going to be in it. You got to love it because you get it in your blood. You can't get rid of it. And that's why I'm still training at 76.
What made Runway Model so good?
I'm going to be honest with you. I saw her before the sale. I watched her work. And she was just an absolute doll, both in her attitude and her management on the racetrack. I fell in love with her, and I asked the guy that was selling them, and I believe, I can't remember his name right now. I'm trying to think who sold me that horse. It'll come to me. But anyway, I asked him what he was looking for the horse in the sale, and he said, I'll take $50,000. I said, what if I wrote you a check for $50,000 right now? Would you sell the horse? He said, absolutely. So I wrote him a check for $50,000 and took the horse home, and the rest is history. I still train for the man that I bought that horse for, by the way. With 20 years in the business, and he's still with me.
That's great.
I would imagine he probably has a small statue of you somewhere in his house, huh? After selling her for $2.5 million.
I don't think so. Well, needless to say, we bought several others, like Shanine Girl and horses like that for him that he raced and made a lot of money with them and did well, and he's done well in the business, but he like he breeds, he sells. He buys, he's in the business, and it's a business for him.
Bernie, since we're talking about some of your outstanding training jobs with some of these horses that have won graded stakes, let's talk about your lone grade one win, which came in 2001 in the Super Derby with a horse called Out of the Box. Tell me about that horse and that experience.
Oh, well, Out of the Box was sold in an OBS sale, and I was right around the golf cart with the owners, and I saw him standing on the side of the barn, and they were showing him to somebody else. And you know, you get a feeling about a horse when you look at him. And I looked at him and I said, my God, what a beautiful animal he is. So we went up. I watched him walk. I watched him gallop. You know, went over him quite as much as I could. And I told the owner, that was Bert Klein at the time, we have to buy this horse. He said, okay. He said, what do you think he'll go for? I said, I really don't know, but I think he's worth at least $100,500 or $2,000, $200,000 in those days. So we bought the horse, I believe, for $128,000, and I traded him pretty much his whole life. And he was another good one that went on to be a stallion. I don't think he did really well as a stallion because he didn't have the classic bloodlines that we were talking about earlier. But he made a lot of money and did win the Grade One. And since then, Mr. Klein has gone on, and he has other trainers, and he's still racing today. And he races in many parts of the country where I don't go, like New York and Florida and things like that.
How's everything down at Fairgrounds? You're still going down there. I know there's been some issues. How's Fairgrounds treating you?
Well, they do a very, very nice job with the horsemen. I mean, I understand the place has gotten older and needs some updating and things such as that, but they kept the turf course and redone the turf course, and it is really, really nice. And I love the turf racing there, as well as the dirt. It's got probably one of the best surfaces in the country. Churchill Downs does at the fairgrounds. That is called River Sand, and it comes from the Mississippi River. It's not very hard to get, and it gets fast when it rains, and it's very seldom off that bad. And the turf course is just beautiful. They had gone ahead and fixed it since Katrina, and they did a hell of a job with it. In fact, I love racing there because the weather's good, the food's good, and the racing is, in my book, top-notch as far as keeping your horses in one piece, which is what I'm all about, keeping my horses in one piece.
Yeah, when you don't have, 300 to choose from, it's a necessity to keep them going and take expert care of them. I know Bobby Frankel always thought that was the best surface that he ever raced on. He used to talk about it all the time.
He's a very good friend of mine, he was, and he loved it, and he came down there all the time. And we used to go out to eat together, and even when he was in California, we went to eat several times together. And he was a real great horseman. He was one of the few that was so sharp, so mentally astute about horses that he's never ridden. I don't think he's ever handled a horse. But he had a brain and a half and was all horse and all horseman.
Bernie Flint, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Bernie, you're... couple of your sons involved with horse racing as well. Your son Steve, a very successful trainer in his own right. If I'm not mistaken, I think your son Scott is a blacksmith in the business. Tell me about those two and all your kids and what it was like to have them become involved with horse racing with you.
Well, naturally, I mean, you know, everybody wants to do like their father does, you know, and everybody wants to be, if they had an idol, so to say, they want to be like their idol. And Stephen was, he's 54 now, and I was very young when I had him. And he's always loved the horses. I mean, since he was a little kid. I mean, you know, he loved them. He went to the races. He's been around horses since he was a little bitty kid. So he knows horses like most trainers should. And he has a job where he's training 60 privately for a gentleman that owns the old Evangel and Downs racetrack. And he has this that was made into a training center. And right now he has 60 over there, and he's stable there and ships to Delta, the Fairgrounds, or Evangeline, and pretty much stays in Louisiana because he's got a salary job.
Well, it's nice to have them follow in your footsteps and to be involved in that respect as well. I'm sure that you must be very proud to be able to say that they're involved with the sport that's been so good to you over the years, Bernie. And, you know, the other aspect of what we see with so many trainers that are at your level that we've had on this program in the past is that they tend to be mentors to young and up-and-coming trainers. And when you think about some of the trainers that have come through your program, so to speak, you, names like David Fox, who galloped for you, is now doing very, very well on his own as a trainer in Florida. You hear Ron Moquet, who joined us on this program last year. He's another trainer that's kind of taken the ball and run with it after going through your program. That's got to make you proud as well.
Oh, God, those boys are successes in their own right. And I'm sure they will go on to be great trainers. They started really at the bottom and worked their way up. And David Fox is really, really a top hand. When I say a top hand, he used to gallop for me and do everything, help me run horses, and he had a mind like a sponge and picked up everything and went right on with it. And so did, believe it or not, Ron Moquet, who I thought was just a young kid when he came around. I never thought, you know, that he would stay, but he stood. When we shipped, he went. When we did this, he went. When we ran horses, he went. Same way with David Fox. It turned out, you know, even my son Steven. I mean, Steven can run horses with anybody in the country. Those guys are a very, very good horsemen.
Well, you know, Bernie, when Ron joined us on this program last year, he spent time talking about you, and he gave you so much credit. He holds you in very high regard. And everybody, it seems, that I've talked to at the racetrack over the years has their favorite Bernie Flint story. And I asked Ron what his favorite Bernie Flint story was. And here's what Ron had to say. I thought you might enjoy hearing what he had to say.
Taking to breakfast. It was around Father's Day, and I took him to he's got some boys, and he was going to spend the time with them. But I wanted to take him to breakfast, and it was on a Sunday, and we went to Cracker Barrel, and it was a long line, and Bernie don't do lines. And we got there. He has a phone. He doesn't have an inside voice. So it's after church, and anybody knows Bernie's colorful, you know, vocabulary, but it's after church, and we're in there with a lot of people that just finished church. And his assistant called and was telling him that one of the owners had said he didn't want to cut this horse to geld it. And Bernie was very upset about this, and he was normally loud, but now even more loud, in saying that, you know, that horse needs to breed like you do, and there's no way, and he's saying some things that could be taken very wrong by anybody, let alone a bunch of church people. And you know how they stack you in at that restaurant, you're right on top of each other, and I'm wanting to climb under the table because everyone's looking at him. And he finally goes, let me go. Moquet's got me in here with all these blue-haired blankety-blanks. And I don't even know if I ate or if I ordered. And then he just went on. He's like, what? What did I do? Yeah, that's the good Bernie story.
Bernie, do you remember that story?
Oh, yeah, I remember. I remember it quite well. He usually calls me Dad, Ron does. As long as a whole lot of people call me Dad, believe it or not. I mean, I get pops, I get Dad all the time, and they do it out of respect. And I am sometimes a little upset with people when I recommend they do something and they don't want to do it for some unknown reason, and I get a little upset with them. And like the particular story you were telling, I had asked that man nicely about five times to castrate this horse. And I said, look, this horse is really dangerous. He's going to hurt somebody. You don't understand how bad he really is. In the meanwhile, I never did talk him into it. I just told him, just go ahead and bring the horse to somebody else. Maybe they could do a better job, you know, and that was the end of that argument. But a lot of times people don't listen to their trainers. And let me tell you something. When you have an honest trainer that tries for you and wants you to do well he works for you, it's sometimes a good idea to take advice from him. And when I say sometimes, let me put like 90% of the time, because they live with the horse and they know what the horse needs. Does he need to be dropped? Does he need to be raised? Does he need to be castrated or something? Something along the lines that's going to help the horse. He's not looking to hurt the horse. He's looking to help the horse. And that's another fault. You know, if they don't have faith in their trainers and they don't understand that trainers are talking, you know, this one's good or this one's bad, you have to get rid of this horse, he's going to cost you money, or you have to do this or that, or go get a chip, which I believe in. Okay, I'm going to make a statement right now. If one of my horses gets hurt, I am going to tell you, I'm going to do everything I can to fix this horse. I've turned him out for a year with different things and brought him back and run him for a fraction of what they were worth before. But anything's better than throwing them to the wolves, so to say. I make a living with horses, and I don't want to see any of them mistreated or any of them abused. I breed horses to this day. I stand a stallion in Indiana called Unbridled Express. He's bred maybe 12 mares. He's got a 1.95 average earnings index compared to a mare index of about 1.35. He moves these mares up. I love him. I stand him. I don't care if anybody breeds to him or not, but he's a great horse. And he ran with great horses, and I know what a great horse is because I've been around him. And he is one. So I breed my mares to him. I have a couple of mares, two, which is unbelievable. I'm still breeding horses at 76. But it's in me, and I can't help it.
You're an optimist.
I'm going to be around him till the day I die.
Bernie, you mentioned knowing what a great horse is because you've been around them. How long does it take you to kind of get a sense of, okay, this horse has what it takes to be truly great? How long does it take you to realize that, and what's the key?
You know, the cream floats to the top. And those horses, those special horses we're talking about, they only come along so seldom. It's unbelievable how seldom they come along. But they make themselves obvious when they do. And when they come along, a lot of them don't achieve what you hope they'll achieve. But again, a lot of them do. And you can't give up on one. When I say give up on one, that's the last straw. So you give your horse every opportunity. Most important thing is you keep your horses with good people that have a love for a horse, and you'll do good in this business. Because when you start dealing with people that take a horse for 30 and run him for 15, pawn him off on somebody else, or abuse them and drop them down or run them where they don't belong, when they can't run, you know, when there's something wrong with them, then you're dealing with trash, in my opinion. And if you have a good trainer will explain to you exactly where you stand in the business. And it's always best to listen to him. And that's my advice to anybody. And if you don't have any respect for him or you don't understand what he's saying, best thing you could do is bring your horse to somebody else and get out of the business. But it's a great business. And like I said, I'm not going to get out. I'm going to stay in it probably, I don't know how much longer. But I have a good time. And again, you know, when I say I have a good time, I'm only looking at 20 head of horses. But that's quite enough for me, 24 tops. So that's where I stand.
Well, you mentioned earlier that you like the horses better than people, and I think that's part of the reason why. I never could understand when I was training how a guy that was sitting behind a desk in New York would know what to do with this horse that I've spent, you know, 365 days a year with, 24 hours a day, basically. How could he possibly know more about this animal than I do? You know, and it gets frustrating sometimes, but that's part of being a trainer, is having to deal with clients.
You got to train people.
Yeah.
And that's hard to do. When you talk about training horses, that's easy. When you talk about training people, that's very difficult. And like you said, how can he know what's going on when I'm living with this horse? And you can tell him, and it don't sink in, because they were successful in what they did before, and they believe that they know more than the trainers do. And most of the people you train for today are very successful. But again, that's when I said you have to have faith in your trainer and you have to trust him. And this is most important. You'll see trainers buy horses for 30 and run them for 15. You've been on a racetrack. It doesn't take a genius to do that. You know, win a race and then run them back right away for 15 or for 10 and win another race. And, you know, that's not right. I want to see one move up. I want to see him improve. And if I buy a horse, I buy him with the intention I'm going to improve this horse. I'm going to try to improve this horse. If I can't improve him, I'm at least going to leave him where he's running at and what I think he's worth. And this is important when you're reading the racing form, too. Some people have the habit of claiming horses and dropping them for no reason whatsoever. And other people drop them for unknown reasons, such as infirmities or something else like that. So trainers are very important. I pride myself in being in the money at least 50% of the time with my horses, one, two, or three. And I pride myself in having my horse be competitive at one part of a race or another. And if you ever see one of my horses running, you can say, I'll bet you he'll be running at the end. I'll bet you he'll be running in front. I promise you he'll be one or the other, and he will be competitive somewhere in this race. And if they're not, you're watching the wrong trainer.
Yeah, well, it's a lot of that has to do with knowing your horses and where to place them. And it's amazing to me since I've been out of the training game since 2000, I see things so much more clearly than I used to. When you're in it every day, you go, why is this trainer running in this spot? The horse has virtually no chance, you know, and you see how
they do it for two reasons. One, they want to get the horse to drop down in price so they can win, or they're trying to see if what they did with this horse was successful. Now, you got to figure out which one of these trainers are doing such a thing. Okay? And that's why when you bet, you know, you must look at your trainers and look at their performance and what they have done and what they have done in the past with their horses. See, all that's important. It's hard to tell people that, you know, hey, look, I put horses where they couldn't win, but I thought I might have solved the problem and might have them under control. But if I didn't, surely enough, you'll see them run early in the front or run late on the end, but they just couldn't compete at that level. But you really have to get a line on your horses, and the only way to do that, you can train the hell out of them in the morning, and you'll not have the same performance out of them that you would in the race. Now, don't ask me why. They used to call them morning glories. And they are around and they are out there. But, again, we try to be, you know, try to put them in a spot where they can win. If we can't win, I sure want them to be competitive somewhere in the race.
Visiting with Bernie Flint on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Bernie, no doubt there's some young men, some young women out there right now listening to this program that are thinking, maybe I want to get involved with training horses. So when a young person comes to you and they ask you about getting involved with this profession, what do you tell that trainer about being successful?
Well, the best thing you can tell a young person getting into the business is you better hook your wagon onto somebody that knows what they're doing. And if you hitch that wagon up to the right person, it'll take you a long way. And there's several of them still out there that's working and have that either been there and done that or are very good and have never been to the top of the line and have never won thousands of races. But that doesn't mean that they don't know anything. That's a big misconception. You have to learn from a knowledgeable person, and the only way to learn in this business that I've found over the years is to get in there and do it. When I say get in there and do it, get in there and do it. You got to rub legs. You got to feel legs. You got to pick feet. You got to look at them and say, what can I do to help this horse? There's got to be something I can do to help this horse. And cross all your T's and dot all your I's, and I tell you what, you'll make it in the business. It's not a difficult business, but you have to have a love for it to be in it. And like I said before, I mean, who the hell is going to breed horses at 76 years old? Me? I don't know anybody else. Not to sell, I mean the race.
Well, Bernie, only a couple of minutes left here in the program. And by the way, visiting with Bernie Flint, it's been an enjoyable hour, really flown by. Bernie has won leading trainer titles at a remarkable 9 different racetracks. I mentioned his more than 3,000 career victories. He has won a record 20 leading trainer titles at Turfway Park. So, Bernie, I'm going to ask you, at age 76, at least that's what you're going to be in 9 days, you're still 75 for another 9 days, what's still left for Bernie Flint to accomplish? What do you still want to get done in the sport?
You know, I don't know. All I know is one thing. If I didn't get on top of a horse in the morning and I didn't ride every day or mostly every day, you know, I don't know if I could, you know, keep myself going. You know, it's kind of hard. It's kind of hard to say, you know, what keeps a man motivated. I'm always looking for the big one. And they always had this saying that I've never seen a man commit suicide that has an untried 2-year-old. And I kind of live by that train of thought. I'm always looking for the untried 2-year-old and one that's going to become a great one.
Well, Bernie, here's to finding that next great 2-year-old here in 2016. And we can't thank you enough for your time here tonight. It's been a truly enjoyable visit. We could have easily spent another hour. And all the best here moving forward this year and beyond. And we'll be among the first to wish you a happy birthday.
Thank you.
It's been great talking to you, Bernie. Keep up the good work.
Okay, thank you again.
All right, Bernie Flint here on Trainer Talk. Like all of our guests who appear on this program, receives a gift courtesy of one of our sponsors. It is Flair Equine Nasal Strips. We will get those out to Bernie. And, wow, what an hour.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Very interesting.
Yeah, great stuff. And we will wish Bernie all the best here moving forward. Don't forget, if you missed any portion of this program, go to our website, horseracingradio.net. A podcast will be available for you to listen to at your leisure. You can also do that, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. And follow us throughout the year at HRRN on Twitter. Fun stuff.
Yeah, it's great. You can download those podcasts, listen to them when you're flying, when you're running, pick out your favorite trainer and learn some.
For our producer, Lee Delapina, for Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk.